workshops, and a Skillshare at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, located at 1001 Southeast Division Street. Again, that's the 16th Annual Portland Zine Symposium, Saturday, July 9th, and Sunday, July 10th. More information about Skillshares, speakers, workshops, and more can be found at kvu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, the hallmark event for the Oregon Food Bank. This year, the festival will be held July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. Everyone will need a pass this year to see such artists as Dr. John and the Night Trippers, Liv Warfield and the Special Horns, Curtis Salgado, and many more. More information about passes, the performers, the role of the Oregon Food Bank, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film premiere screening of Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson, Sunday, July 3rd at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Vietnam veteran S. Brian Wilson was run over and nearly killed by a military train during a nonviolent protest in 1987. Paying the Price for Peace tells the story of Wilson's activism and exposes the truth about the United States' addiction to war and the lies it perpetuates in order to wage ongoing violence. S. Brian Wilson and the film's producer will be in attendance. Again, that's KBOO Community Radio's premiere screening of Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson, Sunday, July 3rd at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S.-made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
Seaweed, what strange things I see below. Cars are waiting, windshields wiping, nowhere left to go. Oh, the ice caps are melting. Ho, 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 ho. Search of land. The children hide beneath the sand, while floating toys come crashing down. I play the fish. I swim around.
And that's about enough of that. That was Tiny Tim from a very strangely tuned in and prescient performance somewhere on some sort of kid show many years ago. Anyway, this is Wednesday Talk Radio, KBOO Portland. My name's Paul Rowland. Be with you for an hour. We are waiting to get our guest on the phone. Not sure what's happened, but we're anticipating talking with Paul Beckwith, continuing on this intense discussion about what's happening to our planet that seems like we're having a hard time taking quite seriously, although we absolutely must. So I'm going to read a few announcements before we get into the program, assuming we will get Paul on the line. Today, Portland IW, PDX IWW Worker Wednesday, Barbecue and Corn Ho, 6 to 9:30 p.m. at the IWW office, the building where they have it, at 2249 East Burnside Street in Portland. The Portland IWW invites you to join them in the backyard of their Union Hall for a casual BBQ and cornhole tournament. We'll provide the basics. You bring something to get yourself in there, which will also get you a spot on the tournament. Prizes include some IWW merchandise and literature. Please also bring your favorite condiment and or a side dish to share. This will be a fundraiser for their hall, so bring a friend, your mom, your friend's mom, co-workers, whatever, support union organizing. Tomorrow, free Leonard Peltier cultural event and discussion, 7 to 9 p.m. Tomorrow, Thursday, at the Clinton Street Theater, Southeast 26th and Clinton here in Portland, 7 to 9 p.m., all ages and open to the public. Join them for a cultural event featuring Native drummers, special film clips, and a discussion with Chauncey Peltier about his father, political prisoner Leonard Peltier. Chauncey will hold a Q&A so you can find out how to get involved. Leonard's artwork will also be on display and for sale. For more information, www.peltierart.com, www.peltier, that's P-E-L-T-I-E-R, justice.com. Friday, 7 to 10 p.m. at the Anaris Info Shop and Community Space at 7101 North Lombard Street, also here in Portland. Anti-Fascist Defense Benefit Show for an Anti-Fascist Defense Fund. Proceeds to go to Sacramento Antifa medical and legal expenses. You all might have heard about the conflict that happened there a few days ago. It's all ages, featuring Old City, Mictlan, and one more band to be announced. Show has to end at 10 p.m., so please come and support folks fighting back in the streets. If you can't attend but would still like to donate, make a comment below, and we'll reach out to you about it. Oh, that was from their Facebook page, so I guess you can't do that. You can go to Rose City Antifa, rosecityantifa.org. Portland premiere screening of Paying the Price for Peace, Sunday at 7 p.m., also at the Clinton Street Theater, Southeast 26 in Clinton. Come to the premiere of Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson, sponsored by KBOO. You've probably been hearing that announcement here on your community radio station. Produced and directed by Bo Bodart, narrated by Peter Coyote. After 4 years of filming, editing, and fundraising, this important and very moving film is finished and ready to be seen. As July 3rd, Sunday, at the Clinton Street Theater, Vietnam veteran S. Brian Wilson paid the price for peace as he was run over and nearly killed by a military train during a nonviolent protest in 1987. Since then, he has not stopped calling attention to the U.S. government's defiance of international law through waging endless illegal wars. Paying the Price for Peace exposes the truth about the United States' addiction to war and the lies it perpetuates in order to wage ongoing violence. He's been in Portland since 2008. You can see the trailer at Vimeo and a teaser at YouTube. Next Thursday, Beyond Fossil Fuel Exports, a just transition to a clean and equitable economy for Portland. Thursday, July 7th, 7 to 9 p.m., First Unitarian Church, Southwest Main Street and 12th Avenue. Join Fight for 15 advocate, Seattle City Councilor Kashama Sawant. Joe Uline of Labor Network for Solidarity and Vancouver, BC City Councilor Andrea Reamer and Just Transition Alliance Director Jose Bravo at a public forum on how Portland can lead the country away from fossil fuel export infrastructure and toward a cleaner, more equitable economy. It's a should be a major event. Go check that out. And Friday, July 8th, you can check out Joe Uline in another vein and venue. An entertaining evening of music and dialogue about the climate crisis and the economic crisis. He's reviving the old style of the song speech. And that's next Friday, July 8th at the Musicians Hall, 325 Northeast 20th, just south of Sandy. And that's at 7 p.m. And that's about what I got for events. Oh, there's one more next Wednesday at Pioneer Courthouse Square. I can't locate that right this second. Oh, yes, here we go. On July 6th, 2013, 47 people were killed in Quebec, Canada, in North America's deadliest oil train derailment. As part of the annual U.S. and Canadian observation of Stop Oil Trains Week of Action, Oregonians will gather to remember the lives of those who died there with spoken word, visual art, and music. And the event here in Portland is Wednesday, July 6th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square. It's sponsored by the Climate Action Coalition. If there's any other events anywhere else in our listening area around, please let me know about them. You can get in touch with me through paulrkabu@gmail.com or come down, leave a note in my box. And we're still waiting. Looks like maybe Paul forgot about this, which would be unfortunate. I was just on email with him yesterday. Well, let me read what I got here. So, and we can talk about it. I imagine just about everyone listening knows something about the researchers who first discovered or confirmed the link between smoking and cancer, or between coal dust and black lung disease, or football head injuries and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. The scientist generally meets great resistance from whatever business interest is involved in the toxic or dangerous product or practice, and often even from the scientific and medical establishments, which themselves are often conservative defenders of the status quo, or at least slow to accept new and controversial findings. For generations of cigarette smokers, coal miners, and football players, all that painstaking research, its eventual institutional acceptance, and its inclusion into changes in business practices and/or government policy came simply too late. Research into the effect of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane have been going on for decades, and the idea itself goes back 120 years. Svante Arrhenius was a Swedish scientist who was the first to claim in 1896 that fossil fuel combustion may eventually result in enhanced global warming. He proposed a relation between atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations and temperature. And boy, oh boy, was he right on the target. As Arctic ocean ice and climate expert Peter Wadhams talked about on this show last week, although there is an overwhelming consensus among climate scientists that the global warming that is now accelerating is indeed due to human industrial activity, there is a much smaller number, mostly field researchers like Wadhams, who have argued strenuously for immediate and drastic social, technological, and political changes to try to cure the planetary disease of overheating. Now there's a new generation of scientists that have grown up with a knowledge of global warming, have learned from the bolder scientists like Wadhams, and now see the rapid changes that those scientists have been predicting unfolding in real time. One of those will hopefully be with us today, Paul Beckwith. He's a part-time professor with the Laboratory for Paleoclimatology and Climatology in the Department of Geography at the University of Ottawa. He teaches climatology and meteorology. He just sent me what else he teaches. Anyway, and environmental sciences. His PhD research topic is abrupt climate change in the past and present. He holds a Master of Science in Laser Physics and a Bachelor of Engineering in Engineering Physics and reached the rank of chess master in a previous life. You know, it's interesting. I briefly worked at a patent law firm for a few months many, many years ago. And there's these people with multiple degrees because the big things were bioengineering and computer software stuff at the time. That was, that was early mid-1980s. And so all these people had multiple degrees in, computer science, engineering, or biology, chemistry, and the law. You know, they were all like both lawyers and advanced science degrees. These are like the cream of the cream, if you will. And a law firm, I'm sure, made millions of dollars. And they're, I got to say, pretty ruthless too in looking through their court documents, their documents that I had to, I was their copy clerk. Anyway, you know, there's just not a lot of money in doing the kind of stuff that Paul Beckwith does. So it's amazing that people with that the same set of multiple skills. Huh. I just got a note that it might be a technical problem getting through to Paul. So we'll keep trying. I sent him an email. Hopefully he'll call in anyway. So I was saying that, you know, there's the system. The system encourages these people who I'm not saying are better than anybody else, but there are certain people who seem to have these multiple skill sets and a certain kind of intelligence that or training or upbringing or whatever combination of things that leads them into these high-powered careers that make a lot of money. And people who fields that don't make a lot of money don't necessarily attract those sorts of people. And unfortunately, those fields that don't make a lot of money sometimes, often, are the ones that we so desperately need to have, like the kind of climate scientists on the cutting edge of understanding what's going on that Paul Beckwith represents. So, yeah, he is no slouch at all. So what I wanted to do today was continue the conversation that I had with Wadhams, the Arctic ice, oceans, and climate expert I interviewed last week on the dire situation of the disappearance of Arctic ice, as well as the Greenland ice sheet that's being affected by the disappearance of Arctic ice that Wadhams explained so eloquently. And of course, the rapid melting of the Antarctic ice cap and other causes and consequences of global climate change. So what we wanted to talk about was many things, among them the idea of being too late. What does that mean? Is it too late? Too late for who? Too late for what? So I drew this analogy in this introduction between scientific medical researchers into, say, smoking or black lung disease or traumatic brain injury and climate scientists. And of course, with the recent revelations about Exxon's role in suppressing their own scientific research, the analogy seems very appropriate because we know so well about how the tobacco industry suppressed knowledge and scientific research into the link between smoking and lung cancer. And of course, we know that the coal industry has done everything they could to suppress knowledge and understanding about black lung disease, and the NFL, until relatively recently, suppressed knowledge about traumatic brain injuries. But still, I'm not sure it really does justice to the what's happening with the climate crisis. Terrible as the suffering and death of countless thousands of lung cancer victims, black lung disease victims, you can add asbestos victims, and on and on and on, as the Dire Straits song has it, industrial disease. What we're talking about with the acceleration of global warming in process right now is something so much vaster in scale that it's difficult to think or even to talk about it or even think about it. Because it could potentially mean, I hate to use such dire language, that every single one of us alive today has a terminal case of cancer. That would be the analogy. So we're still waiting for Paul Beckwith. Let me just talk to my engineer, Liam, here. So, Liam, did that phone number, did you actually get a message that it was Paul Beckwith's number? Okay, he's nodding yes. Well, I apologize for this, but the number to call in is 503-231-8187. This is a big subject. I'm devoting a lot of attention to this because I feel like it is really the most important thing to address on planet Earth. And I say that with, I think, full understanding of, as much as I can, a privileged white male person living in Portland, Oregon, in the United States of America, I do have a pretty decent understanding of how drastic conditions are for people who are suffering the brunt of the police state, of industrial practices like living in Cancer Alley in Louisiana, or name your spot, living in Appalachia in the coal mining area, being an indigenous person, an African American person. But as I said, this climate thing is goes beyond all that, because it, you know, the idea that we've had, you know, the idea that progressive have is that, you know, with time and with diligent action and, you know, working at various levels, that we can ameliorate things. You know, slavery was ended, civil rights legislation was passed, and of course, I think all those things were really basically masked a deeper problem, essentially. But, you know, you can't argue that certainly ending slavery is not, is obviously, no one could say that ending slavery is a bad thing and that there hasn't been some progress in those areas. But what I would argue is that climate change is like, you know, I don't know how much people know about the idea of cumulative impact in terms of ecology. The cumulative impact is, you know, when you're looking at a watershed, every single logging operation in itself doesn't destroy the river system. But if you add up during the heyday of logging, all those different operations, they end up having a massive toll on the salmon or on other key indicator species like the northern spotted owl. And then you take that to, you know, whatever level, whatever ecosystem you're talking about, the cumulative impact of all the development, all the disturbance of soil, of, you know, of the animal species adds up to what's happening now is a basically a biological meltdown, massive disappearance of species. And the climate crisis is really the cumulative impact of all the cumulative impacts in terms of the biosphere. So we're still waiting on our guest, but it looks like people have things to say. So let's just go to our first caller. Harry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Paul, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, yes. Last week I tried to call in, but your line was busy. You were talking about climate change, but is climate change supposed to happen? I mean, the warming of the Arctic, is it supposed to happen? I mean,
what do you mean? Is it supposed to happen? It's happening right now.
Yes, but in the cycle, we're in a glacial cycle. That's an ice age cycle that happens every 29,000 years. So
No. We're coming out of the last ice age way faster than anywhere in the arc in the record. It's what's happening now. We're experiencing things that have not happened actually on planet Earth. The kind of concentrations of carbon dioxide that we're seeing doesn't happen in a terms of a natural cycle. This is something that has not happened. Do your research.
Yes, but also the research says we have a glacial time.
Right, but this is separate from that. This is separate from that.
We have 3,000 years of warming to do before the Earth starts to cool again because of our glacial cycle.
No. The Arctic ice has not been like this for over 100,000 years. This is a different situation that we're facing. This is a different situation we're facing.
But archaeologists have found bison and all types of animals around the Arctic Ocean, which is in the top of the Earth. So they found trees and everything else like that. So does this supposed to happen this way? And that's the question I have. And also, we've seen in human lifetimes, we've seen climate change. Example, Turkey. There are some cities in Turkey that 2,000 years ago were actually on the sea coast that were harbors. But they got silted in, and now the like Ephesus, you hear about that in the Bible. Well, it's 6 miles from the ocean. So we do have some, and also Sahara Desert. 5,000 years ago, it was a nice place to live, but now it's a complete desert.
Right. Okay. So sure, there are cyclical changes. What I'm saying is this is different from all those cyclical changes. This is something of an order of magnitude different from all those previous changes. There's the long cycles of the ice ages. There's different cycles of the sun fluctuation. But human industrial activity has pumped more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than those processes on top of whatever those processes are, has led to concentrations of carbon dioxide that are fundamentally changing the fabric of our biosphere. We are risking having a completely ice-free Arctic with either this year or next year or the year after. That kicks into effect these incredible feedback mechanisms where you no longer have the reflectivity of the white ice and snow, and so it kicks back, and then it starts from the Arctic, and that goes into the Greenland ice sheet, and that starts melting at a more rapid rate, and you lose the ability of the fundamental flexibility of the Earth system to maintain this very stable, relatively stable climate regime that we've had since the last ice age, in which human civilization rose and has for some people flourished. For my point of view, it's basically been the downfall because it led to industrialism, which is unraveling our biosphere. This is something different that's happened. I urge you to do the research. Go to Peter Wadhams, W-A-D-H-A-M-S. Go to Paul Beckwith. Look up his videos and look up their writing. Look up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Do your research. I encourage you.
Okay. Hey, thank you for taking my call.
All right. Thanks for calling in. Well, we're still waiting for our guest who may not show up today, but looks like we'll have a show nevertheless. Let's go to our next caller. Vernon, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, my God. We're all going to die. Good morning, Paul.
Hello.
It's not easy to accept that humans have probably brought on the sixth great extinction. We've very likely signed our own death warrant and we're going to take out an awful lot of other species with us. But it's heartening to note that we don't likely have the power to end life on Earth. And maybe in the big picture, our role was to be like massive earthworms digging up the petrochemicals that were deep under the soil and spreading them all around to create opportunities for life to evolve in new and interesting ways.
Well, I don't know. That's kind of an interesting way of looking at it. It doesn't really give me, I mean, it's sort of a fatalistic, I don't know. I tend not to look at things that way. I tend to look at things that, you know, here we are, you know, we had a really good thing going for thousands of years, and like, why do we have to mess it up?
I agree. And I, you know, I'm doing what I can to change my lifestyle and that of my community in a way that will allow my great-grandchildren to enjoy this beautiful planet. And
well,
there is something of the inevitability of death that has to be dealt with. I mean, in fact, it is there, and eventually humanity will end. Hopefully life will continue as long as this planet keeps spinning, and the living universe is a whole bigger question.
Well, but what these scientists are talking about is that we still can actually, you know, what do we actually have to do is the question. I mean, there's the first question is, can we all agree that this is actually happening? And our previous caller didn't seem to agree. And of course, if we had Paul Beckwith on the air, he would have been able to much more concretely address those concerns. I am not a scientist, and I have not assimilated this information, obviously, to the degree necessary to be able to do that. But so the first thing is, the first question is,
you did a pretty good job, Paul.
Well, the first question is, do we agree? Do we have a common understanding what's actually happening? That's the first step. Okay. So
yeah,
so we have to discuss
I think
that.
In a sense, you were both right, because in fact, it is a greater cycle. I mean, it's a cycle that, frankly, the current ice age in the larger term sense of the term. You know, there's been ice on the planet as long as there have been humans on the planet, longer than there have been humans on the planet. And to get to a place where there is no ice on the planet, as swiftly as we are getting there, will probably end the opportunities for humans to be on the planet. And that's the reality we need to deal with.
Right, right. And so the point was, okay, so...
And that will eventually happen. The question is, how quickly are we going to drive it to happen through our own behavior? And how many of us are willing to accept things like, I can't drive a car anymore?
Right. Okay. But I was, those are all valid questions. And there's various efforts. You know, there's this climate justice, climate protection movement that has arisen in the last few years that is, you know, slogan, keep it in the ground, no more fossil fuel infrastructure. But what these scientists like Beckwith and Wadhams are arguing is that actually it's no longer adequate to just do that. So I guess the point is, like, are we really up to speed on what's actually happening? Because they're saying that we're past the point of actually being able to keep under control these feedback loops of the loss of sea ice, the release of methane, that we actually need to draw carbon out of the atmosphere and probably even do some geoengineering like solar masking to reduce the, to reflect some of the sunlight back in the atmosphere. I'm totally resist those ideas. But what I'm saying is an accurate scientific understanding of what's actually going on might lead to different conclusions about where we're at and what we need to do. So if we actually need to draw carbon to the atmosphere, that's a project at a scale that we're nowhere near even beginning to know how to do it effectively. It would require, you know, people are talking about like a Manhattan Project style or, you know, a World War II mobilization style. But we're not anywhere close to doing that because we're still locked in the same ideological struggles, the same old, competition, capitalist competition. So we're, you know, but what I'm talking about here on this program is just us as a community of listeners of KBOO and of people in the Portland area. Can we try to come to some common understanding of what we're facing? That's the only task I'm setting. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, and I appreciate you exploring into that. I am looking forward to hearing from your guest. And I do believe that we can't have too much knowledge. I think it's always good to explore further and deeper. I do believe that we need to get down to what does this mean to my life? How can I live my life in a meaningful way that gives the most hope to future generations? Because I think too many of us expect some big government project to come save us. Well, you know, you use the Manhattan Project as an example. Well, look at what a great job that did of saving the planet, for Pete's sake. You know, and
right,
that was
right, right.
Well, created nuclear weapons.
Right. Well, the analogy is totally – the analogy is not that we want to do something, do the what the Manhattan Project did is the analogy is the scale of coordinated deployment of resources, right? But coordinated deployment of resources.
Yeah, we can do that without the secrecy of the Manhattan Project and without willingness to accept the collateral damage that the military always seems to have. Yeah, I'm all for it.
Right. And there's so many other...
We need to coordinate and cooperate and put our resources to the best possible hopes we have. I believe that it comes down to, you know, the best thing you can do right now is build topsoil. A good guest, actually, in the future would be Kirsten Olson. She's right there in Portland. She wrote an excellent book called The Soil Will Save Us. And she does have a real insight into how we can turn this thing around.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Vernon. Let's go to some other callers.
Thank you, Paul. It's always pleasant to hear you. You have a wonderful intellectual style on the radio, and it's great to have someone of your caliber on TV.
Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure I deserve that, but
thank you.
So, you know, that's right. You bring up a bunch of issues. You know, again, so the issue of rebuilding the soil, of course, that's a component. What the problem is, there's all these different pieces, and they sometimes sort of work at cross purpose, because this person will say that we need to rebuild topsoil. This person will say we need to plant trees. This person will say we need to do massive geoengineering. This person will say we need to keep going with the divestment strategy. This person will say, and so there's not even coordination amongst the different groups that are working on these issues. And so I despair, frankly, that we will get over these issues. Even here, you know, at KBOO Radio, there's, you know, not a lot of common understanding here at the station about, you know, how all these different issues relate to each other. You know, we're trying to serve an entire community. We're trying to talk about all these different things. But are we able to, you know, prioritize? I mean, is prioritizing even a good thing? There's a lot of complicated stuff. But let's go to another caller.
Harvey from Berkeley calling.
Go ahead, Harvey.
Well, here's some good news to start with, that on Monday, the Oakland City Council said no to a coal export terminal out of Oakland.
Right on.
So that's really good. But talking about the melting of the polar caps, one of the problems with the melting of the polar caps is that the water... there's a displacement of water, and it moves towards the equator. And in doing so, it creates more movement in the Earth's tectonic plates. And the movement of the Earth's tectonic plates gives rise to more volcanoes and more earthquakes, and bigger and larger earthquakes. And that means, like here in California, a negative was that yesterday the California Lands Commission voted to let the Diablo Canyon stay active for another 9 years. And with the melting of the polar caps again, you're getting more and more movement of the tectonic of the earthquake lines, the fault lines, including the San Andreas is starting to move. And unfortunately, there's a fault line right underneath the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant called the Diablo Cove Fault that's linked to the shoreline fault line, that's linked to the Hasgari fault line. And in the Santa Barbara Channel, off of Santa Barbara, they've just lifted a moratorium on fracking. There's 19 fracking platforms offshore, and the Hasgari fault line moves right through there. So we know that fracking can cause earthquakes. The USGS and the US Army has told us that fracking causes earthquakes. So they could rip the Hasgari fault line open, which would again affect the it's connected to the shoreline fault and the Diablo Cove fault, which could create a nuclear meltdown. But up around where you are, the acceleration of earthquakes could cause the Cascadia subduction zone to start moving, and you'd have a tremendous 0.9. The largest earthquakes in the world happen in the subduction zones. So these are the overall effects that could really ruin everybody's whole day. But one thing that the fossil fuels do is that they're second only to agriculture in their daily consumption of our freshwater resources. So I recommend that for people who install solar panels on their house, that they get what I call a solar water credit for the water, because once manufactured and installed, solar panels use no water over their 20 to 25 year warranty. So to preserve our freshwater resources, which are diminishing actually worldwide, I would advocate for a solar water credit for people who install solar panels on their house. So those are some of the issues that are really important. I don't think people realize.
Okay.
When you say melting of the polar caps, it doesn't really sound like much, but it could mean the eruption of the Cascadian subduction zone.
Well, that's all very detailed and complex stuff that hopefully adds to our understanding. It's basically the reality is we don't understand where we're living. I think people before industrialism had a better understanding of where they and we were living. And I think this alienation from the earth itself is both a cause and a consequence of what we're seeing. And unfortunately, my view is that things are happening so fast that we really do have to prioritize. It's almost like triage, that we may not have time to work everything out. But it looks like, Harvey, thanks for calling. It looks like Paul Beckwith is here with us at long last. Paul, what's going on?
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I'm glad we finally got you.
Yes, I messed the time up. I thought it was tonight.
So, oh. And
I had my phone off because it's my son's graduation today, so.
Oh, well.
From grade six. So, anyway, I apologize.
Well, we've had a bunch of callers. We had one caller early on who might still be listening who was basically making the argument that, you know, we've always had these fluctuations of ice ages, and that in some sense, I think he was basically implying that there's nothing unusual about what's happening with the melting of the Arctic ice. That's a kind of a climatology 101. Maybe you want to just quickly address that question.
Yes. Yes, there's always been fires on the planet as well. But, you know, the fact that there's more fires now because things have dried out and we have drought, we have less rainfall, we have pests damaging the trees, you know, making the trees, for example. So there's more fires now. I mean, you can't say there's not. We've always had fires, therefore, climate change can't have anything to do with the increase. You have to look at the statistics. Of course, we've always had changes in temperature globally because of orbital cycles, and then these orbital cycles affect feedback. For example, you know, if there's a general cooling, less sunlight on the planet, then there's a general cooling, and then there's more CO2 absorbed in the seawater. And we get a drop of temperature that's amplified, and the same thing when there's warming. So yes, we've had those things, but humans have changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. We can measure. We know the greenhouse gas concentrations. We know how greenhouse gases trap heat, and we also know the composition of the oceans and what's in the oceans. And we're increasing the acidity. The thing is, the rates of change are at least 10, 20, maybe 40 times faster now than they've ever been in Earth history before. And we can measure, so we know these things. So, you know, that argument really doesn't make any sense.
So I just saw your latest post on your website that the jet stream is moved south of the equator. That's strange.
Yes. I've never seen this before. I'm talking to meteorologist friends. I've talked to a few. One of them goes back to 1984, and he says he's never, you know, he studied meteorology then. He's been following it ever since. He's never seen it happen. I mean, but essentially what's happening is, normally you have jet streams in the northern hemisphere. You know, you have one or two, and they circumvent the planet. And you also have jet streams in the southern hemisphere, which circumvent the pole. And what's happening, because the Arctic is warming so much, the jet streams in the northern hemisphere are slowing down and becoming much wavier. So they're traveling much farther in the north-south direction. And they've traveled so far south that they're actually crossing the equator. And where they're crossing the equator, I don't think that meteorologists thought this was possible. because the equator is generally much warmer, so the air rises much higher in the lower atmosphere, in the troposphere. So the height of the troposphere where weather happens is about 17 kilometers near the equator, and it drops to about 7 kilometers high near the pole because the air is much colder there. So the air actually, it's like the, in order for the jet stream to cross the equator, it almost has to like climb a mountain, if you like, you know. So what's happened is, one area that I've noticed is we had a very strong El Nino, which warmed the oceans in the Pacific at the equator. And now we've headed into a La Nina, where the Pacific waters at the equator are colder than normal. So if you look at the temperature near the equator of the sea surface temperature, it's actually warmer away from the equator than it is right at the equator. So if the jet streams in the air, of course, penetrate, you know, down to such a low latitude, then they're finding their way across. I've just never seen this phenomenon before. And, you know, it's very concerning. You know, it's one of these huge surprises that the climate system is capable of throwing at us.
So,
and, you know, we're seeing these things play out because what the jet streams do when they slow down and become wavier, that's the reason we have all these extreme weather events. And again, we've always had extreme weather events, but we have a lot more of them now, and they're more severe and they last for longer, and they're in regions that we never had them before. And this is because of the waviness of the jet stream. So this is now, you know, so this is new behavior. The jet stream is now crossing the equator. So that can, you know, what does that mean to us? That's the big question.
So, you know, it's kind of late in the show, and ironically, that was what we were going to talk about. Is it too late? What does too late mean? A whole series of questions around that. But, you know, in the last 15 minutes here, I've been trying to, you know, before you came on, I was trying to impart in my own non-scientist way a sense of urgency to, you know, continue the conversation that I had with Peter Wadhams, who you know well, last week, who was talking about the disappearance of the Arctic ice and the drastic implications that is having and will have at an accelerating rate on the global climate system, and what that means for us as a seemingly robust species, but also just a mortal species and vulnerable to the forces that are at play on planet Earth. So what can you do to, you know, you're doing something different, I think, than scientists traditionally have done, is you're doing YouTube videos, you're coming on the media. Obviously, there's more climate scientists, more scientists doing that, still a relatively small minority than before, obviously, because you yourself see what's going on. Talk about your own sense of urgency and how that is driving what you're doing as a climate scientist.
Well, so I was just at my son's grade 6 graduation, and all of the kids stood up, not all of them, but a lot of them, they stood up and they said, you know, what their dreams and goals were, say, you know, where they wanted to be in 10 years, you know, where they wanted to be in 20 years. And I found it very sad because, you know, I really, the way the climate system is changing, I just, you know, we're doing a number on this planet. I think we need to declare a climate emergency on this planet. I think we need to zero fossil fuel emissions within 10 years. I think we need to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. I think we need to cool the Arctic, because once the Arctic, once we lose the sea ice and snow cover, then the weather extremes are going to get much, much worse. And we're already seeing there's evidence all around the world that things aren't right with the climate system. And yet I don't, you know, I walk around and I just don't see the sense of urgency. I attended the Canadian Association of Physics conference for a couple weeks ago, and there was a week of physics talks, very smart people, and there was only one talk on the Arctic, which talked a little bit about climate and weather patterns, and that was it in the entire conference, and it wasn't very well attended. I mean, people in all different professions are so specialized that they're just not opening their eyes. They don't want to believe that we're in trouble, that our planet's in trouble. They don't want to believe, or they don't look for evidence, or I don't understand. Like, I think this is all going to come out very soon in society. I think the general public will go from this, you know, not caring too much or not knowing what's going on, to utter panic. And then when that is achieved, I think we'll start doing things on an emergency basis. So, but is it too late? I mean, when you think about what that statement means, when somebody says it's not too late or it's too late, like that sentence, that statement is pretty meaningless, really. Like, you know, what is it? Like, of course, it's already too late for some people. It's already too late for coral reefs, perhaps. It may be too late for we could lose sea ice completely this summer. It's too late for losing sea ice, at least initially. It's too late for certain levels of sea level, certain amounts of sea level rise that are built into the system. It's too late for that. We're having mass migration. The Syrian drought in 2006-2010 forced 1.5 million farmers to get killed their livelihoods. They had to move to cities, and then Syria broke apart. The many of these migrants have gone to Europe, and they've caused, you know, the ramifications of the Brexit, for example, is a country closing up basically to immigrants. Like when you know, are people really going to react this way when things get really bad? Like, what about when there has to be mass migration from Florida, for example, because of sea level rise? Are people in surrounding states going to happily accept huge numbers of people that are migrating, or are they going to start putting walls up? I mean, we have, you know, Trump, of course, talking about building walls. I mean, we're in a terrible situation on our planet right now, and I just don't understand. It seems so obvious to me. I don't understand why more people can't see this.
Well, because,
maybe they can.
I think that you're getting to some point. You use the term twilight zone a video I saw of yours kind of struck me, that the kind of that strange disjuncture, anybody who's watched Twilight Zone, that strange feeling, the eerie kind of feeling of being out of place, of something being disjointed, you know, someone finding themselves in another time, another place that they should totally unexplained, that kind of eeriness. I think that kind of, it's difficult that it's when it's actually, you know, it's actually reality that is doing that to us. It's we're reacting as if we're in a film that we can just sort of turn off. We're acting as if, and I think those are, you know, that's because of the kind of social conditioning that we've processes that we've created. And I think it's really, we're acting in these ways that are based upon a world that is different than the world we're in now, and so it's no surprise to me. But obviously, someone like yourself is closer, apparently, if one can believe, you know, if one believes in science, if one believes in physics, if one believes in climatology, that you're actually seeing more clearly what's going on, and you're attempting to relay that to the rest of the people. And of course, there's going to be resistance to that, but I think it's extremely valuable, and I hope you keep doing it. And I think we had one more caller. I don't know if he's still on the line. Let me get my engineers. Well, let's just keep going. We had Charlie.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Respond to what I was saying.
I think this is what more and more scientists are starting to they're starting to come out of their shells, if you like, to discuss to the public, you know, how frightening things are. Attracted this comment. I mean, the jet streams, I've never seen them cross the equator before. I mean, this is just another indication of really how fractured and messed up they are. You know, the melt rates from Greenland and Antarctica are increasing on an exponential basis. You know, there is increased methane emissions from the Arctic, from the continental shelves around the Arctic. And so, you know, is it too late? I mean, what does that really mean? I would argue that as long as there are people, you know, on this planet, you know, then it's not too late for them to try to survive, right? Like we need to increase the vocabulary of how we describe the problem, because, you know, people will argue ad nauseum, is it too late or not too late? And yet too late to some people means, you know, if it's too late, then we're all going extinct. That's what too late means to some people. Other people would say that too late means that we're going to have severe disruption. So they're completely arguing about completely different things to begin with.
But one thing that I think people don't really get, perhaps, is the fundamental unprecedented nature. I had on the I can't remember his name, the great 9/11 researcher Griffin, David Ray Griffin, I think, who has a book called Unprecedented, because it's really difficult to see things. We look through our eyes again at reality and the way that we're accustomed, the way that it has been for us, and people are like kind of in their own world, mental worlds, and have a difficulty of seeing the real world to begin with, I believe. But the unprecedented and the speed at which things are happening is, you know, it's almost like you have to be a climate scientist and you have to have already studied these things to see that. Do you see that playing into this?
Yes. This is, I mean, there's definitely, you know, climate, there's a lot of science. There's a lot of different components to climate change. I mean, there's a lot of things going on, and a lot of people find it very confusing. And then add to that confusion the intentional deceit, the intentional lying from different, from fossil fuel interests and large corporations that want to maintain the status quo. So there's a lot of confusion thrown into an already complex problem. But that's why I really try to sort of pull out the basics. I mean, what are the fundamental basics are? We've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. We've changed the heat properties of the atmosphere. It's absorbing a lot more heat. The chemistry of the ocean is changing. It's affecting marine food chains. It's affecting plants and animals on the Earth are migrating towards the poles at a very rapid rate because the warming is so great that their ecosystems that they thrived in before are no longer the right temperature range. So they have to migrate towards the pole to try to regain the temperature range in which they're comfortable with. And then that changes the whole ecology. It changes everything. You know, we have uncontrolled exponential population growth, and we also have a large increase in consumerism. So the demands on the Earth system are increasing tremendously. You know, and they had like they're accelerating. I mean, the CO2 level in the atmosphere, you know, it's probably going to rise about 4 parts per million this year. You know, just over 3 last year was a record. And so things are spiraling upwards ever more quickly. And, you know, the people on the planet just sort of churn along and you know, suddenly they're in for a really rude and abrupt awakening.
We all are. Well, listen, we're just about out of time. apologize to our listeners that we weren't able to get you on for the full hour. I apologize to those callers who were not able to get on. And hopefully we'll be able to have you back on for a full hour at some point. And paulbeckwith.net, I believe, is your website where you can look up your videos and your writings, right?
Yes. So I really encourage people to look at the latest video I posted late last night on the crazy behavior of the jet streams, which I don't think we've had before.
Okay. That's going to have to do it. Thank you so much for being with us, Paul Beckwith.
Okay, thank you. And I apologize for the time mix-up.
No problem. And thank you all for listening. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, the hallmark event for the Oregon Food Bank. Once again, with our partners at Oregon Community Media, KBOO will be broadcasting the four-day festival in the Portland metro area, across the state from Astoria to Ashland, and from Andrews to Antelope, and around the world at KBOO.fm. Remember to support your local food bank as you tune in to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, to enjoy the 29th annual Waterfront Blues Festival.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Soul City Supper Club concert series on Saturday, July 2nd at the Star Theater in Portland. This month features local soul artist Ronnie Wright with new vocal diva Tamara Stevens and surprise guests from the Bespeak Project. The event will also have guest DJs, door prizes, and more. Again, that's the Soul City Supper Club concert series with Ronnie Wright and Tamara Stevens on Saturday, July 2nd at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.